Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hi, it's Jackie Cation, and you are listening to the Dork Forest. The website's jackiecation.com, dorkforest.com, thedorkforest.com if you like a determiner. Let's do the credits. Patrick Brady's going to fix this audio and video. Vilmos works on JackieCation.com. And Mike Rickberg sang the song with his wife, Sarah. He composed it, and he will sing his version of the Mexican hat dance at the end of this show. Thank you so much for listening to the Dork Forest. Here's a scoop. I'm doing stand-up online. A lot of Zoom shows will eventually go back on the road. Sign up for my email list. It's easy to get off. It's harder to get on than it is to get off. And no harm, no foul, if ever bored. JackieCation.com. Sign up for the email list. You'll find out about my weekly Zoom shows and stand up on the road eventually. You may donate to the show if you would like. I would like. Sure, I would. There's PayPal, Jackie@JackieCation.com, and there is a PayPal button on both DorkForest.com and JackieCation.com, and there's Venmo if you like Venmo, Jackie-Cation, oddly enough. If you have listened to all of the shows, go to dorkforest.bandcamp.com, I think. The Dork Forest has a Bandcamp page. You can listen to a lot of ones that are free from pre-2009 when I started pre-recording. And then there's live episodes that cost me a couple of bucks, so I charge you a couple of bucks. There's also some stand-up. There's a story album that's very exciting there. And other than that, I have a lot of merch in my garage. Feel free to order if you know anybody who doesn't have any CDs or the DVD. And you can follow me everywhere at Jackie Cation. Let's get into the show. Hi, I'm Jackie Cation. I'm in my living room, and I am with another comic from 800 Pound Gorilla, which I will be recording with eventually. But by God, Arthur Gauss. Is it Gauss?
Yes, it is Gauss.
Good for me. Stand-up comic from the Bay Area has an album out right now. Nice jokes for smart people. It sounds lovely, I have to admit.
Yeah. It's if you don't like it, it means you either like dumb jokes or you're a dumb person.
Oh, wait a minute. Arthur Gauss is throwing down, everybody. And what you should know is comedy subjective. I'm sure everyone will like it. And if you want to follow him, it's at @maniac_bowl, like the Super Bowl, but he's a maniac bowl.
Right.
Maniac_bowl. It'll be in the notes. And what I find interesting, so this 800 Pound Gorilla album, by the way, is out everywhere now, right?
Everywhere.
Okay. So go and stream the hell out of it. You can do it. Nice jokes for smart people. Arthur Gauss. That's what we're talking about. Now, here's my, so your dorkdom, though, you gave me the most eclectic list of, I was like, I need one thing, I need five things. Give me five things, just in case, because we don't know each other. Look familiar.
Well, we met one time backstage at San Francisco Sketch Fest, but that's it.
Okay. And I was like, I'm sure he's plug and play. I'm sure. But if I don't know somebody very well, I'm like, I'm going to need five topics. And
let me just say that this was a small sampling of the topics that I am utterly, utterly dorky about. This took some editing.
Oh, fair enough. Well, feel free to bore me with the minutia. First of all, I love history. So let's start with San Francisco, where you're from. And the thing that happened in 1915, which I've never heard of. What is it?
Okay. San Francisco Panama Pacific Exposition of 1915.
Panama. Okay. Right?
It took place in San Francisco. 1915, San Francisco was a fraction of the size population-wise, a fraction of the size, you know, geographically. There were whole places in the city that hadn't been built because they were later landfills.
Mm-hmm.
But it had this outsized clout because if you're on the West Coast of the United States, basically it was the biggest city for a long, 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 long time.
Right?
Like LA wasn't really a thing yet. It was San Francisco and maybe a little bit Seattle if you were on the West Coast.
Right.
And but then unfortunately we did build this great city on a fault line. And in 1906, the city both was reduced to rubble and then burned. So
oh my gosh, that's right. The San Francisco fire.
Yeah.
Yes.
But it fell down and then the rubble burned. And incidentally, there was a guy, there was a plan for this. They did actually have a plan for this. But the guy who came up with the plan, he was struck by a falling brick and was killed. And then his house burned down.
Is your doorbell ringing?
I think my doorbell is ringing.
That's okay, as long as you're willing to ignore it and your loved one will go and get that door.
My wife and the baby are out, which means that, like, it better not be them.
Okay, do you want to run and get it? You can. I can pause this. Let's just pause it.
Maybe we should do that.
Yeah, Zoom recording. Of course it was Amazon. Well, that's fine.
I guess.
Yeah. But what I like was the intensity of, no, you have to answer the door right now. And you're like, because they just leave, like, they will throw things over my wall. They don't care. You have a very earnest Amazon deliverer.
No, that was let the record show, let the audio and discursory record show that was three doorbell rings.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of it. A lot of things happening there.
She would have kept ringing for the entire hour. It was, we had to knit this.
Okay, so the fire was in 1906.
Yes.
And then there was an earthquake and then a fire, and the guy who had the plan died in said fire or rubble.
Yeah, he was hit by a falling brick. The plan was, if there was an earthquake and then a fire, the plan was that they were going to blow up Van Ness Street. Just blow it up.
Wait. What I like was, because I thought you were going to say, the plan was, is if there was a fire and an earthquake, we were going to talk to this one guy. You would think this, why was he the only one who knew?
Unclear. But the plan was in a safe in his house, reportedly.
Okay.
Yeah, which is right where you want to be.
Right. Yeah. Which I'm sure the safe was very safe. I mean, once they unburied it.
Well, I mean, let's put this together, though. They later found the safe with the plan intact because they opened it up. They found the plan and was like, that's what we did.
Is that what they did?
Yeah, that's what they just blew up Van Ness Street. Blew it up.
Why?
To keep the fire from spreading any further.
Okay, so they created a moat.
It was called the Ham and Eggs Fire because, like, there was this earthquake and everyone was like, wow, I'm going to need breakfast. And then they lit their stoves. So the main gas went up. That's what started the fire. So because all of that was kind of located around Van Ness Street, all that piping and stuff, they just dynamited it. And it was to stop the fire from spreading.
And did it work?
Yep.
Okay. All right. And did you grow up in San Francisco?
I did.
That's why you have this sort of background of information of, like, I have a cursory knowledge about the cow in Chicago. Anyway, because I was geographically close to Chicago and they had a big fire. So
that's right. They were fire twinsies in our civic.
Right. The Chicago people are. Milwaukee, when things burn down, nobody writes any sort of poetry about it. Because I'm from outside of Milwaukee. So
yeah, they have in Milwaukee, they have plaques about, like, great shipwrecks down by the river.
What do they?
Yeah. You walk around that with the third ward, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, you walk around there and they've got plaques about, like, here was a tugboat that sank, but those plucky Irishmen saved 10 lives.
Yes. You know, made a difference to that starfish. We're not a large city. Anyway, unlike San Francisco, we are not the definitive city of the Midwest.
I would not go that far, man. Like, there is something Midwest about Milwaukee.
Oh, it's a gorgeous, it has a lot of, what I like to think about Milwaukee, so there's a lot of potential. It's got a lot of potential to be something. We could have been something. And until then, we're just going to be ourselves and just keep plugging away. Talk to me about, so then 1915 happens.
Yeah, so San Francisco crumbles, burns, and it's a zoo. I mean, it is a zoo for like 10 years.
Wow.
The zoo was literally in Golden Gate Park. They just moved the animals out there. People were living out there. It really was a, do we even want to rebuild this kind of question?
Wow.
And they decide to rebuild it. It's this great civic achievement. It's why San Francisco's flag is a phoenix bird.
Okay.
Yeah, the slogan is, it's oro, oro en guerra, fiera en pax, gold and silver, iron and war, gold and peace.
Okay.
So the Phoenix becomes a symbol of the city, but they need to get people to come back here. They need to attract people. They need to attract tourists. They need to be something.
They need an event.
So they come up with this idea, the Panama Pacific Exhibition of 1915. And it's to celebrate the opening of the Panama Canal.
Sure, which is not anywhere near San Francisco.
Correct.
It's but in at the Panama. Time,
yeah. But at the time, if you wanted to go from New York to San Francisco, you had to go all the way around down South America, or you had to go overland.
That's right. And you could go now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Through the locks.
Yeah, if you were it like a lot, there's a lot of great reasons to go through the Panama Canal. Smuggling, money laundering, military. Cultural rot.
Right. Just some sort of random appropriation of whatever you can keep your hands on and jam into a hold of a ship.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Large scale weapons operations, that sort of thing.
Sure.
So, but at the time, it shaved 3 months off the trip from New York to San Francisco.
Okay.
So they're going to have this big thing. And they decide, well, not only are we going to do this big thing, we're going to build a whole neighborhood of the city. A full-on, renovation addition to the city, which is now the Marina District. And they build this thing called the Palace of Fine Arts.
Okay. Right? I have performed in the Palace of Fine Arts.
I have seen Hall and Oates at the Palace of Fine Arts.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were they together?
It's Hall and Oates, man. Of course they were together.
I was just like, you, there was such a pause there. I was like, oh, did they have solo careers? I didn't know.
If I said I saw Hall and Oates and you fired back, like, oh, it was just their Hall. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, it was Hall and Oates.
It was Hall and Oates. That's right.
Yeah, I wanted to be sort of prepared for that. So yeah, they build the Palace of Fine Arts, which you have performed at, which clearly still a Palace of Fine Arts if they're booking you.
Sure. Right?
Host of many, many outdoor teenage keg parties at the Palace of Fine Arts.
Sure.
Still the premier location. So they build it. They build this beautiful neighborhood, and they turn this whole neighborhood into a giant art fair promenade.
Okay.
It's like you got to think like 1915 version of Art Basel.
What is Art Basel?
It's like this giant art fair that attracts like a bunch of people in various degrees of tastelessness.
Okay.
To Miami to purchase art.
Okay. So it was a bit of a free-for-all.
Free-for-all.
Okay.
Free-for-all. And so it's this giant effort to import art from all over the world and bring it to San Francisco. And the theme sort of develops that the Panama Pacific Exhibition is truly the meeting of East meets West.
Okay.
It's the end of the American frontier, and it's the place where the Pacific American interacts with the greater world.
Okay.
And you please believe people had strong thoughts about that. Like half of the American art in the display is like pilgrims being like whipped out of New England and arriving in California where like bare-chested women are handing them oranges.
Really?
Yeah.
That's
really.
An actual where there's so what was there so, wait, now let's unpack this a little bit.
Yeah, no, there's a lot to unpack.
Right. Is there some sort of speculation that California was settled by people who couldn't take, they're a little too uptight over in Massachusetts, so we're going to strike out for California where it's the roads are paved with oranges and gold and boobs?
Why has anyone ever moved to California? I mean, that's the reason, right?
I didn't get the memo. I understand that does make some sense, though. Allow me to.
Yeah, there's some like truthy Americanness there that like you go west to get away from that to arrive at this.
Right.
And then you can almost hear the Beach Boys playing in the background.
Yeah, but it's 1915. So who knew that they had this crazy ass attitude back in the day? This is burned in, you're telling me.
Yeah. Well, this is sort of the beginning of it as like San Francisco International Kooky Art City.
Okay.
It's sort of the beginning of that. And like, you know, and also, I mean, the art is like fantastic. It became this like really big exhibition, like all of this new stuff from that whole thing that happened in European art where they started imitating like stuff from Tahiti and Africa and stuff like that.
Oh, when was that?
Well, it's
I remember them copying the Greek stuff and the Roman stuff in England.
Yeah, and this was sort of there was sort of a shift away from that where they started imitating stuff that they were seeing in
from
other parts
Africa and the Caribbean and stuff like that.
And yeah, and Tahiti. What's the,
I don't know. Coconuts and bare-chested ladies are all that's coming to mind with Tahiti.
Yeah, no, it's the guy who was friends with Van Gogh and Gauguin. Out of here, man. Like, I've had enough of him, man. But anyway, this was the sort of art that was on display, and it was like this really influential art, and like you see a lot of the pieces that were on display in the San Francisco International Exhibition, mm-hmm. and like you recognize them, and it's like there was this whole, it kind of like sharpened the identity of San Francisco as a place you could go to be an artist, a place where they appreciated the arts.
Okay.
And much of the art that's collected here in San Francisco. And like on display in the museums comes from the Panama Pacific Exhibition, and it sort of has this like outsized place in the imagination of a lot of San Franciscans, like myself.
Okay, and you were raised to sort of think about this Panama American Exposition as not just like it was the birth of sort of the artistic intelligentsia that made San Francisco to what it was. What was it before then? Was it just a mining facility or a place where you guys had to find the bay? That's what I remember, that there was a hundred years where no one could get into the bay.
Yeah.
Because of the fog.
The fog, and there's like the bay is where all this swirling happens and then goes back out to sea. So it's where seawater comes in and goes out, and it creates a little vortex there. And there were a lot of shipwrecks.
Okay, and so, but they couldn't tell where the real mouth of the bay was.
It's hard to find. Yeah, it's
tricky. Tricky.
Yeah, it's not exactly easy to find.
It was hiding. The planet was like, you guys go around. Why don't you guys go around?
Exactly. Head south to Los Angeles.
why don't you go to Monterey or something, or drop some stuff off and then hump it overland like the weird beasties you are.
Yeah, exactly. Just like, yeah, that looks like more of a Santa Cruz shipment.
Right. It's like, because and the only reason I know that, I think I read some sort of historical fiction where they put up a sign or a light where it's they're like, it's here, you guys, your giant arrow.
There's a couple of lighthouses. Like they eventually had to put in a bunch of and like that. But it's not easy to get into the bay. But it was like there was gold in the North Country, of course.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And my husband
grew up in Oroville, which is
really
Oro. Yes, that's ore. That's gold.
You know who also I believe is from Oroville is Jackson Pollock.
I don't know that. I think he would have mentioned that. Are you sure?
I think that's true.
I know that Guy Branum is from Yuba City.
Touchdown Guy Branum and I, he and I were on the first time I ever got paid to do comedy was with, we came up in San Francisco at the same time.
Oh, okay.
I believe he has roots in Minnesota and Yuba City, I believe.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he does. Cause he got, one of the weird little fun facts about Guy Branum, he's done the program a couple of times, is that he got a full boat scholarship to the University of Minnesota Law School.
Yeah.
Which is not surprising if you know Guy Branum, but is also like, what? Anyway, so
yeah, he's from
Yuba City. Yeah.
Yeah. My brother went to University of Minnesota Law.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
All right. But you're from fancy San Francisco. You know,
I'm actually from grimy San Francisco. I grew up in Haight-Ashbury.
Okay, that feels even more cred, as opposed to Lori Kilmartin, who tells me she's from San Francisco, and then she grew up in Walnut Creek. A lot of silence.
What?
Yeah.
I mean,
she's San Francisco comic, for sure.
she must even, like, in the privacy, like, when doors are closed, acknowledge that that's a bit of a stretch.
Oh, we do it publicly on our on my other podcast, The Jackie and Laurie Show, where I openly say, you keep saying that, but it's Walnut Creek. Yeah. And it's like saying you're from Boston, but you're really from Worcester, Mass., and which is outside of Massachusetts. It's another town.
It's a different continuum in the Massachusetts continual universe, you know?
Yeah, and a lot of people make fun of Worcester. I don't mind Worcester myself. I actually have played Walnut Creek. I'm not above anything, is what I'm saying. I've
where'd
been
you
to
play,
Victor
where did,
played
yeah, where'd you play in Walnut Creek?
The pool hall for Greg Osdorian. Oh, why see. Wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you?
Why would you say?
Who doesn't want $100 on a Wednesday?
Yeah.
Five years ago.
Yeah. Well, and also, like, where'd you get the $100? Got it at the pool hall. I mean, that never sounds anything other than cool.
That's just good dialogue there. That's good times. You're like, oh, there's 13 people that are kind of interested, and then another 30 that are genuinely playing pool.
And yeah, then, that like are breaking some kind of laws in a variety of order.
Yeah, and there's absolutely no way that that was somehow better than Zoom shows.
Yeah.
Oh, so calm down.
Can I tell you that this is just a little aside? The last time I played Walnut Creek, I did a show at the Lesher Center. And I was doing this character named Guy Vaudeville.
Okay.
And it was a Will Durst show. So we were like, you know, he greets the crowd afterwards.
Yeah.
And we were sitting there and this guy comes up to me with a little hat on and he goes, I'm so glad to see somebody doing vaudeville. My grandfather was a vaudeville great. It really hit home with me. And it was like three generations of like little vaudeville guy. Like there in Walnut Creek.
Hat in hand or hat on head.
Hat on head.
Yes. It's that is hilarious. I went, all I know is I got to the pool hall gig early and I had to find somewhere to eat and I didn't want Subway.
Yeah.
Like I didn't want Panera or Subway and that was right. all there was. Right. And the only other thing that there was incredibly high upscale like steak and sushi places.
Yeah.
So it was like, there were also small chains, but small chains I'd never heard of, but sort of like hoping one day to be Ocean Air or something. And it's not that, well, I mean, you can make fun of South Milwaukee, Wisconsin until I'm old and gray. I mean,
they did elect Paul Ryan, did they not?
That's Janesville, Pete Lee's hometown. Sorry.
You know what? My bad. Sorry, I brought it up.
And I used to do a joke about Paul Ryan. Looks exactly like the guy who date raped me in college. And I am not saying he did. I am just saying that he looks like the guy. That's all I'm saying. Anyway,
the man provokes a response.
Yeah, and that response is almost entirely negative. Dude's a haircut. Anyway, but the great thing about the history of San Francisco is that this seems to be kind of a turning point, this Panama American.
Yeah, it all leads to stand-up comedy, right?
Because does it?
It always does. Because you get the Panama Pacific Exhibition becomes a place. San Francisco develops this reputation as a place you can go to be an artist, where artists are like can make a living, et cetera, et cetera. So it starts attracting artists, and you know, there's the and then by 30 years later, there's this big artistic boom in San Francisco. There was the Bay Area representational painters, and like they were all based out of North Beach. And then, like, right almost at the same time is the Beats and the painters are hanging out together. And then the Beat poets.
Let me just make some snapping noises.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. The Beat, well, because Lawrence Ferlinghetti just died.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't kill him. Who is he?
He is founder of City Lights Books, which was it's a place where all the Beats hung out, you know?
You know what? I think Greg Proops just did this program, and he might have mentioned that to me as well. But every time I am reminded of City Lights Bookstore, which I enjoy as a destination, but not as a place for me to buy books. Because the last time I was there was right after, I think it was right after the election in 2016. And I walked in and I said, I need something light. And the woman behind the counter said the funniest thing. She said, we don't really do light.
Yeah.
And then I walked out.
Yeah, no, they do. Yeah, they do dense.
Yes, yes. It is chock full of academia. You want to learn some things? The lightest thing is going to be a Howard Zinn thing. You want a little people's history of the United States? Howard Zinn's your... And I like that book. That book is actually very well written as far as conversationally. Yeah. But it is also very dense.
It is extremely dense. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of... And it is not light. It is
No, it is not light. And I needed something light. And they did. And I liked her honesty.
Yeah, I love it when clerks are honest. Mm-hmm. I once went to a record store in Paris, and I bought a bunch, and I was like, your store is absolutely, it's great. It's so good. It was good. It was a great store.
Yeah.
This very hip Parisian woman just like puts down the records I bought, and she goes, "I know," and then continues.
Right, she is aware. She is aware. It's funny. That did you ever see the movie High Fidelity?
You know, I haven't.
You're not missing a great deal.
Okay.
It's a super fun movie. It's John Cusack, essentially the rich man's Paul Rudd, or maybe the other way around. Can't tell. Anyway, but John Cusack essentially plays a guy who has two incredibly beautiful women and fighting over him, and a record store that he owns that it's the coolest place in the world. And Jack Black works there. And
does he choose the record store?
What?
In the end, does he choose the record store?
I believe he does.
Yeah.
And it's a boy and his dog. And so, but I think that it's such an interesting film because he has absolutely, because it should have been not called High Fidelity, but Quality Problems is what it is. Because there's absolutely nothing wrong with this guy's life, except for that he's a bit of a sad sack and he can't pick.
Yeah.
So, but there was instances of record mocking, of the mocking of what you've chosen.
Which is like such a dumb thing to do. You know what I mean?
It's not
like,
inclusive at all.
Yeah. It's like what would only make my life better? If I had someone else to like compare record collections with. So yeah. If you are doing that, like, what am I going to make fun of you? Like, who the hell am I? You know?
Right. Welcome to the Dork Forest. You guys, Arthur Gauss, I don't understand why you haven't been on the Dork Forest before. Cause that is the attitude that we're looking for on this program.
And mind you, I am quite, quite dorky.
And you should know this is that he has a new album out on 800 Pound Gorilla called Nice Jokes for Smart People. It could be you. You could be the people that he's talking to. So what else, like, did they do hot dogs? What else was at this expo? I mean, did it just blow your mind that it was so much, it made the art available?
Well, first of all, it worked. Like,
oh, did it?
It got people coming back to San Francisco. It was very much like San Francisco's back, baby.
Yeah. And even though we have earthquakes and fire.
Yeah, this will happen again, playa. But like, while we're here, man, just check it out, dude. Like,
look what they're doing with paint.
Yeah, look at what we're doing with paint.
It's going to be amazing.
So a couple of big things about it, right? The buildings from the Panama Pacific exhibition are everywhere still. Everywhere.
Okay.
The Palace of Fine Arts is still up. The big Conservatory of Flowers in Golden Gate Park.
Yeah.
I believe that was built for the Panama Pacific exhibition.
Okay, so this wasn't like a world fair where they kind of half-ass put some things together. Like the built-to-scale replica of the Parthenon is still in Nashville from the world fair, but like usually like nothing else. Like usually they build like one thing and they keep it. You're saying that they built several things. I mean, they had space, I guess.
Well, and they kept the neighborhood. It's just now the marina is now that's where the Panama Pacific exhibition was.
Is it called the Esplanade? What is the marina? Is that different than the Esplanade?
I mean, it's the northernmost point of San Francisco.
Okay.
It's, It is like sort of the hip place to be if you are extremely wealthy and young.
Okay, but isn't that the entirety of San Francisco right now?
To some extent? I mean, it is not the same place I grew up. We can be perfectly frank about that. But
sure.
It is, and in some ways, like, San Francisco has always been a place that sort of, like, attracts people who think they're going to make a fortune out west.
Yeah.
There's some resonance culturally with, like, doing that.
Right, and everything changes. I mean, my hometown is not the same as it was when I was a little kid either. And there's nothing to be done about it. And 20-somethings with a giant bag of money are always going to, there's always going to be a change. And the gentrification, there's a name for it now.
Yeah.
But it's always existed.
Yeah, know? And that, but that's not to say, there's two things about that, is it's true that it's always happened, but that doesn't, like, alleviate the injustice of it. And particularly as it relates to the, you know, the disruption of the disruption of communities that had been there for a long time, kind of like regardless of circumstance, you know?
Oh, do you know what they did in Milwaukee? They took the highway system and they split the black community in half on purpose, it turns out. Because I don't know if you guys know this, white supremacy, not new.
No.
And on purpose.
No. And that's, it's always been on purpose. They've always been trying this stuff. They'll be back in some other form. Like,
right.
These people, and this is what they do.
They're not cutting Chinatown up, are they? Can you still go to Chinatown?
Chinatown is still, I mean, look, like everywhere else in town, like, it's until this is over, it's all going to be, you know, up in the air. But Chinatown, I went to grade school in Chinatown.
Okay.
And it's always going to be Chinatown. You know, it's, there would be some cosmetic changes, but these sort of changes happen. And also, you know, it's like, I feel the other thing that's sort of true about these sort of things is that, like, they're inevitable, but that doesn't alleviate the injustice of it. But it does sort of, like, force people who've been here to preserve some of the ethos of it, you know? And like, to the extent that, like, people are talking about saving San Francisco, like, which really to
you keep
it can really
the
sound
table,
quite droning. What's up?
You keep hitting the table, and there's tiny emphasis because the tone of your voice doesn't go with "you guys." It's
I'm sorry. The point is that, like, it's important for that's why I'm sort of interested in the Panama Pacific exhibition, is that, like, some of this stuff about being an artist and some of this stuff about, like, you can do it here and you can be weird here and you can take chances here. Which I think is definitely a part of our, like, comedy culture here, like, sort of has its origins in the Panama, some part of its origins in the Panama Pacific Exhibition.
Well, I mean, because San Francisco, I think, I mean, the first thoughts I have when it comes to San Francisco is it's sort of inclusivity, you know, that it's inclusive and that it wants you to be who you are, you know, and it wants it to open up. And, you know, the shows that I've done in San Francisco, both Sketchfest and the Punchline, and Cobbs, and then, like, Mill Valley, are all so very different.
Yeah.
But I think that there is, even if you're a billionaire, there's a part of you that wants that, you know, even those billionaire kids or the olds who are billionaires, who come to the show. And it's so weird when a billionaire comes to a comedy show. I was like, I thought I would be brought to you on the backs of elephants.
Yeah.
Why have you come out of your home anyway? It's because they actually do want there to be art, and they do want it to be weird, you know?
Yeah. I mean, art is, like, it compels people, you know? And it's like, why would a billionaire do anything other than, like, roll around in his own money, you know?
Yeah.
And order pizza. Mm-hmm. Like, why would he do that? And it's like, because he's looking for something greater. And, like, I think art of any kind fulfills that need. And so it's like, when somebody's like really, really rich and they go to a comedy show and they look a little bit lost, but then they're laughing like everybody else, like, you know, that's an aspect of inclusivity that, like, I think makes it so transcendent. And I think we've always had that here.
And it is great. And it's so funny that we're sort of being sympathetic to the billionaires of the world who deserve very little sympathy, no. quite honestly. But they are, it's not like they aren't human. They're just idiots.
Yeah, no, greed is greed is greed. But like inclusivity, but like if the onus is on sane and reasonable and empathetic people to extend the mantle of inclusivity. It's our responsibility. You know what I mean?
Like, right. It's as irritating as it is. I have to be a decent person, even if you are a monster.
Yeah.
And I'm going to fail, by the way, occasionally. Yeah. If the last 4 years have taught me anything, is that I am not going to take the high ground if you take a very much the low ground.
Yeah.
I'm going to be a piece of shit as well, right back at you. And I'm not going to feel good about it though.
It's that feeling. It's that not feeling good about it afterwards that like, I think
separates.
Yeah. I think that's a fault line. And I think that's like where sometimes you have to like make your, it's like, it can be, it's, and that it's like, that's going to be different for different people, you know?
Sure.
And like, but it's like, as long as the fault line kind of like comes along sane and reasonable,
civilization.
You can make decisions.
Yeah, and I genuinely believe that civilization is inexorable. So, and the advances that we make in it are tiny.
Yeah.
And it is slow, but it is very, very, and sometimes it's bigger. You know, sometimes there are upheavals in sort of glaciers and earthquakes. This type of analogy, but for the most part, civilization is very slow.
Yeah. Now, this is sort of a really nice thing to sort of land on for the Panama Pacific Exhibition, because it was sort of this East meets West thing, which is like very, very strong in the imagery that's associated with it. It's like, you know, there's these giant reliefs of like Europe, you know, moving, coming across the ocean and then becoming wagon trains and then arriving in California. And then from the East, like a bunch of Eastern-looking people to American eyes in 1915, and like San Francisco, you know, a giant Atlas figure is holding them apart, standing on San Francisco. That sort of imagery of East meets right. West and the inexorable march of civilization was a big, 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 big theme. But one of the things that I think is really true about that we're realizing in our contemporary age is that it wasn't like a slow march of civilization towards barbarism on the other side. It was the slow march of a lot of different civilizations moving towards one another.
Right.
And arriving in San Francisco at the Panama Pacific Exhibition of 1950, and get your tickets now, you know?
Get your tickets now. So what else? Like, did they have panels? Was it the first Comic-Con? Like, was it just art? What else was, how was it? Was it just, did they have technological tents,
yeah,
stuff like that? That's what I'm hoping. I was hoping that it was like a World Expo where there were,
yeah, it was like a World Expo, but it was focused on art. So they had like different, you know, gadgetry and stuff like that. But it was mostly about bring us your paintings and bring us your sculptures.
Okay.
Because we want to see them, baby.
That's it. Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah. And actually, you know, it's funny. If this inexorable march of civilization, like spreading out across the land, that really has some nice resonance with one of the other things that I sort of suggested to you, which is the Athenian democracy.
Right, right. Because I thought that that's where you were going to swap it over to. But we can talk about sort of the cradle of civilization in Western civilization was Athens.
Right.
And or it was when I went to grade school and junior high. And in other cultures, it was other things. But
right.
What was, for you, 5th century Athens was a big fucking deal? What? Talk to me about this.
Huge deal. And no, and like, you got to hear me out on this, man. Like, so background. I minored in classics. I was a major in history. I minored in classics. And I am that, I just never stopped reading history. Like, I never stopped. I love it. I read.
That's awesome.
I've always been interested in Greek history. So.
Did you take ancient Greek?
Yeah, I can read it.
To this day, you can read it. Because I took Latin. I was going to study the classics. And they told me I was going to have to take ancient Greek. And I was like, Nah, I think I'll do stand-up.
Yeah, look, I got to be honest with you, man. You missed it because Latin's the boring one.
Latin's the boring one?
Yeah, Greek is like lots of people doing it.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, I bet you it's a lot dirtier. Oh, interesting.
Way. Like the Romans were like pornographic in kind of a gross way, mm-hmm. but the Greeks like they were also quite pornographic, but like,
right, but they were just polyamorous.
Well, and they were also, yeah. but they were doing it in dactylic hexameter, man. Like they were getting all the way dorky with it.
It's you know what when I look back on Chaucer and I think to myself, you guys are doing it in iambic pentameter. I might be mixing my metaphors, but mixing my references. But the thing is so you took Latin, you took Greek, and yes. you studied history, and thus and ancient Athens, kind of inspiring. Right?
Yes. And well, here's the thing. And there's this big debate about like in classics now about like, should we just blow it up? Like, is it too overrun with like Proud Boy lights? Is it just, you know, is this whole thing about like that, you know, the Greeks and the Romans being the paragon of Western civilization? Is that really about like, are we the best, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm here to tell you, I've heard those. It's like, and so it's important to remember, but I think the big change here that's sort of afoot is that people are realizing that like, that at the same time that Athens was happening, other great civilizations were happening and they were all trading with each other. It was all happening, you know? But what makes Athens unique and this period of Greek history really unique is that what's clear to the Greeks of that era is that they believed their democracy made them strong and their democracy made them great. And okay. the reason why they were better than everybody else, and they were, and they knew it, was because of their awesome democracy. And it doesn't look anything like ours in a lot of ways.
I was going to say, please define their democracy because it was very different. If
it was
I remember
super
correctly.
Different. Now, there are some similarities, right? There's some key similarities. So, voting. People could do it. That's how they made decisions. They voted.
And the qualifications?
It was like, for certain positions, you had to be over 20 and male and a citizen. And for other positions, you had to be over 30 and male. But it was always male citizens, which, you know, obviously.
Right, right. And
it rings a little tin.
Right, right. Well, and always will. But that doesn't mean it wasn't real. But you could vote for certain positions if you were in your 20s, and you could vote for certain positions if you were in your 30s. Or are you talking about running for things?
You could hold those positions.
Right, right. No. I'm talking about the voting rights.
Like, the voting.
Who got to vote?
The voting rights is the universe of people who could vote is mostly males over 20. Citizen
males over 20.
Males over
okay.
20.
Yeah, right. I was wondering at the age. I knew it was male.
Yeah.
I will not be shocked. This isn't my first rodeo.
Yeah, exactly. You're never going to believe this, but they didn't let the women in.
It was nuts, you guys. And they had slaves. Weird.
Yeah. Anyway. Now listen, while you're sitting down, let me tell you who built this sweet-ass Parthenon.
Yeah, let's not blow your mind here. But yeah. It wasn't union labor, you guys.
Yeah, right. It was not union labor. But those sort of things are instructive too, is that like, remember that like who actually built these great civilizations? It's a lot of people who didn't get the credit. And, but the whole notion is that they had some really interesting concepts about democracy that were specific to Athens and that were like specific to sort of the Athenian, because there were other city states in Greece that had like varying forms of democracy. But like for the Athenians, it was like, you know why we're the tightest is because our democracy is the best. And this whole idea of like, you know, only a few people could vote because only a few people were citizens. It was tied necessarily to some idea that you had to have some skin in the game. That like, because there was this distinction in the Athenian imagination between andres, like citizen people, and hoi polloi. Which is like hoi polloi is like, that's like the people who overrang the capital. It's like who even cares what they think, you know? It's like they're just barbarians, you know?
So there were citizens and there were barbarians.
Yeah, well, there were citizens, and then there's people whose interests didn't matter because they didn't have any skin in the game.
What do you define the skin in this game?
They
were not landowners.
Yeah, they didn't own land. They didn't have a business. They didn't have some sort of economic interest in the functioning of the city, I think is sort of how they might describe it. Okay. And that's sort of like what sort of distinguished between resident of Athens and citizen of Athens who had to participate in the democracy,
which is another thing they regarded as kind of compulsory. They regarded what as compulsory?
Participation. Like you had to do it.
Right.
Like it was like jury duty every day kind of thing.
Well, it's so what was the population of Athens in the 5th century?
About 30,000.
Okay. And how many citizens were there? And how many residents were there?
Oh, well, actually, no. I think it was like there were 30 to 40,000 people in the city and about I think it was like 20,000 of them were citizens. Don't quote me. If I get angry emails from classics professors later, like, first of all, my life would get way, way better.
That's so awesome. You're just like, do you want to talk about this for an hour, please? Teach me this again. I knew it once.
Yeah, I'm like, thank you for your email. I would like to discuss further.
yeah, it's a classic. It's a classic moment. But it's, you know, because because I think what I'm getting is that you love the ideals of it.
Yeah, totally. And like, I like the idea of, I like the way they valued it, for sure. And okay. That they regarded it. And here's another thing that they discovered, because it was the opposite of inclusivity for a long time in the Athenian democracy. However, when the chips were on the table and they had to like fight the Persian War, and they had to figure out how they were going to drive off like a Persian force that like outnumbered them like 10 to 1.
Right.
They realized that like, well, we're going to have to make a lot more people citizens. And it was, they established the Navy, and they basically said, first of all, you have to join the Navy. If you're a male, over any fighting age male, sorry, man, you're in. Mm-hmm. However, when this is all over, you will be a citizen.
If you live, with service comes citizenship.
Right.
And yes, Heinlein. but that's where Heinlein got it from, because it's an old template for citizenship. And it's but I love the ideals of people that they're like, these are rights. You know, these are inalienable rights.
Yeah.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Right. And the Pericles, in his famous funeral oration, specifically talks about like sort of freedom of discourse and like individual and like the individual rights.
Yes, because the individual is such a big deal in Greek philosophy back then. And which is one of the things that we did embrace so greatly. But it's so interesting It's like any art, to go back to your Panama America thing, is that there are these people with these great ideals, Thomas mm-hmm. Jefferson, Pericles, and they have, their hearts are in the right place.
Yeah.
But they also want to fuck a 15-year-old. And
yeah, apparently like Pericles, his first big political feud against Aristides, like maybe possibly originated over the affections of like a teenage boy.
Sure, sure.
That's in the record. But that's one of the things that makes classics so interesting, is that these like great brilliant men were like also these venal creeps, you know, and actually prone to just like stupidity and bouts of folly. And it's sort of, instead of showing that like ancient Greek civilization and their ideals was better than everybody else's, it's more like, The real lesson is that like these great people were also prone to the same frailties, and they created institutions that were prone to the same frailties. And so a little bit of humility would be nice every once in a goddamn while.
right. And the civilization I speak of is the fact that, you know, we and it's a lot faster now, right? Society. Right. So
way faster.
You write your treaties.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about the injustice that is happening.
Right.
And then someone says, oh, but you make all of your money by selling Post-its that are made by toddlers on 11th Street. And so you can respond to, you're like, well, this is the ideal. The treaties is the ideal. I'm not going to be living like that. I'm going to have a slave and I'm going to rape things. And but the thing is so where we're at now is because those minds still exist, right? Those men and women are still coming up with, built on the shoulders of these published works from the 5th century.
Yeah, yeah. And also, one thing to always bear in mind about the classics is we only have these texts, thank you very much, thanks to the efforts of some non-Europeans, and thanks to the exclusive efforts, almost, of non-Europeans, who realized that the ancient Greeks were onto something, and when a bunch of people, and when these texts were being burned, they preserved them,
right,
and then gave them back to us just because they were being nice.
And you think about the Elgin Marbles. But the who was it? Was it the Arabs and from North Africa who took a lot of their stuff?
This is where it starts to, like, the specific geographical location starts to get a little hazy. But I believe, and again, don't quote me on this, unless, like, classics professors out there, feel free.
feel free to email and tell us, because this is all half-membered. It's
awesome. Yeah, I believe that this is, that the this was, like, these texts came into the hands of Arabs and then Persians, who already knew a lot of the mathematical concepts sort of independently. Like, they already kind of understood that the Greeks were correct, but had come about it from a different way. And then I believe, don't quote me on this, but this is like an expert in the, one of the experts in these texts was Leo Africanus, who became like, he became like a, homeboys with the Pope and like brought back a lot of these Greek and Roman texts into European society. And that's when we have the Renaissance.
Right. There was, Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco is historical fiction. And the great thing about Umberto Eco is that that's a guy who does do all of his research. I mean, and he passed away, I think, about last year or 2 years ago. But his historical fiction, and he wrote about the Name of the Rose and the reintroduction of Aristotle into the post-Dark Ages, after the Middle Ages. And Africanus was a big deal in that. And then, because I remember there's another, Arthur Gauss, by the way. Everyone should, maniac_bull, 800-pound gorilla album called Nice Jokes for Smart People. Nobody wants to read this book unless they do. I have a fiction novel that is historical fiction that might be adorable. It's essentially Raiders of the Lost Ark, but it is written and it is set during the Middle Ages, and it's about a guy who leaves Ireland and joins on the sea, and he's like 13 or 14, or it might be Wales, whatever. It's in the British Isles.
Yeah, it's rocky UK.
It's rocky UK. His castle has been burned. His uncle or his cousin has killed his, father or killed his mother. And he's got to go find his father, who is a spice trader. And he discovers the civilized world in the Middle Ages, in the Dark Ages, when Europe were eating their own shit.
Yeah, who knows what we were doing. Whatever we did, we didn't write it down, man.
And it was gross. It was foul.
Yeah.
So he took a trip in this book to North Africa, and then to China and the Orient. And so it is called The Walking Drum, and it is a book by Louis L'Amour, the guy who wrote cowboy books that Ronald Reagan loved. I've read them all. Mostly because I used to shoplift books when I had some problems at the library. I had a fine. I couldn't pay the fine.
Yeah.
So I had to steal books from Kmart. And once you start stealing books from Kmart, what you're allowed to read gets real narrow real quick.
Yeah.
So all the Louis L'Amour novels. I've read them all.
So you were. So do you believe that this was because you were stealing Louis L'Amour novels?
Mm-hmm.
And which, first of all, top flight name, Louis L'Amour. You were stealing Louis L'Amour novels, and do you think that like some like right leaning supervisor saw you doing it and was like, "No, let her go. It's time for her to learn."
I think everyone who's ever worked at a Kmart really has to. You really have to be a self-starter if you're going to care about the shoplifting situation at Kmart.
Right. I mean,
yeah.
How far are you willing to go to save that toothbrush, man?
Right. It's 1977. You're making $3, $4 an hour. It isn't good. I'm stealing Harlequin romances and Louis L'Amour novels. Yeah. So, and a bunch of mercenary, like action novels set in Africa. Yeah, there was literally, they had like three different kinds of books. They had like action-y kind of books that were Westerns and soldier books, soldier of fortune books. And then they had romance novels. And
Right. I mean, you can see that this is fucking like, some of the same strings, you know?
Right. Well, it's all pulp. It's all just, you know, and there was, you know, mediocre sex in all of them. But they were all about 220 pages and could fit into my back pocket. So,
and that's enough.
Yeah. And the joke's on me, really, because they were so addictive that I stopped reading nonfiction for a long time.
What kind of nonfiction did you read?
It was mostly history. It was, I really liked the French and Indian War and the Civil War starting in junior high. Grade school and junior high. So,
man, you want to talk dorkdom?
Yeah, I do. Like, I do want to talk. That's what we're doing here, man.
Like, well, I mean,
we've weaned off.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Ken Burns couldn't keep it under 30 hours. I mean,
right. And it's whatever he is vaguely interested in. It's a 30-hour thing on jazz or baseball or the Civil War or the national parks.
Just to be clear, I could do that's some dork.
Have you
I can
seen
relate
them all?
To that kind of dorkdom. You know what I mean?
Have you seen those or?
Oh yeah, I watched the Prohibition one on my honeymoon. I mean, like if it's a dense, fact heavy, narration plain documentary, like non buzzy documentary. I haven't done country music.
Okay.
Yet.
Did he do country music as well?
Yeah, he did country music.
A lot of pan and scan there.
Oh yeah. And
how was Prohibition?
Superb.
What did you learn about Prohibition that I might not know?
Oh my goodness. So Prohibition, like here's one thing that I learned from, and this is a big one because I think that this has informed everything that I've thought about Prohibition since then. And that is like, don't forget that like America definitely had a huge drinking problem. And that is no friggin' joke. Like they said that the average American was taking down 9 gallons of whiskey a year.
Okay. Has that gone away?
9 gallons? Like, I mean, that's an incredible amount of whiskey.
Math not being my super, not one of my dorkdoms, not one of my, I don't know how much whiskey that is a day. What's nine gallons into 365 days?
Yeah. I mean, think about like.
There's 16 ounces in a.
You're talking about draining. 32? Like a handle of whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're talking about doing more than one of like almost a little less than one of those a month, which means that like you're pouring yourself a lot of whiskey every single day.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of whiskey. I agree. A gallon of whiskey. How many fluid ounces are in a gallon? Do we remember offhand?
Is it metric system, not one of my dorkdoms.
that would be English. And but the thing, so hey Siri, how many ounces are in a gallon? It's a podcast, you guys. We're all in this together.
1 gallon is 128 fluid ounces.
Okay. How many ounces are in 9 gallons? How many ounces are in 9 gallons? 1,152 fluid ounces.
Okay.
So 1,100. Here's my favorite thing about the Dork Forest is that there's a ranger going, I knew that. Now, I assume you're about to do math, Jackie, and and I know it's happening out there. Gentlemen, ladies, I know that you're out there going, it's fine, Jackie. It's a lot of whiskey. Just accept his what he
just
said.
Just accept the premise. Right. I mean, but
it might be 3 ounces a day. It might be 3 ounces of whiskey a day. And so that's 3 shots.
And that's leaving aside, beer, that's, first of all, the wine. Average American, that's beer, wine, anything. It's like, that's just your whiskey. So you're drinking like whiskey it's a staple item at the grocery store.
Right.
So, and like there was a lot of attendant problems. Like there was a broad conclusion that there were just too many drunk young men around. And as a person who has been around a lot of drunk young men, I can say that there are always too many drunk young men around.
Even when there was prohibition, the drunk young men, they might have gone down, but two is too many drunk
young
men.
Yeah, two is too many. You know what is my number, like my preferred number of drunk young men around? Zero.
Big goose egg. Yeah, a lot of nothing.
Yeah. So, but anyway, so there was this big, there was just too many people getting drunk and getting involved in domestic violence incidents, losing their money and being involved in gambling, that sort of thing. And so this temperance movement sprung up, and it was in some ways a very organic movement. And in some ways, like Alcoholics Anonymous basically started like during the drunk years of like American society, that like a couple guys met in Baltimore, and it was because like they needed to find another way, and that was aligned a little bit with the temperance movement.
Okay, so when did it become illegal to buy and sell alcohol in the United States? Do you remember?
1918, I think.
Okay, and then repealed in 1929.
I feel like repealed in 1929, but then like beer, it was like they brought beer and wine back first.
Sure.
And then they're like, okay, you can have the hard stuff.
Yeah.
And like, I think it was full repeal in like 31 or 32.
Right. Because so they had a problem with public drunkenness and with the drinking problem in general. And then, so they created prohibition so that they had a problem with organized crime.
Yes. They had a problem with organized crime. But they also had...
There once was an old woman who ate a fly. I don't know why she ate the fly. Perhaps she'll die. And
yeah, exactly. It was just one problem following another. And well, and also that like they realized it was too great of a price to pay, including like politically. Like people started running on like, I'm bringing back beer. You know?
Right, right. And you're gonna get votes on that. Yeah.
Please believe you're going to get votes on that.
You're
from Milwaukee. Yeah, come on. Yeah. Like, you're getting votes on that.
I was weaned on Pabst and Ho-Hos. So there's no, yeah, and weird thing about alcohol, because I was wondering about prohibition, is that Alcoholics Anonymous was founded in 1939. So it started in 1935. But the book came out in 1939, and it became national. So, and it started in Akron, Ohio. But
then we're talking about a different temperance organization. But one of the big ones, and so I, you know, forgive me for getting the organization wrong.
That's
and
all right.
But there was a different temperance. Maybe it was the Temperance League. But so it often was,
there was huge temperance leagues.
And it was like just a couple of people who wanted to dry out. And
right. And I think AA was a response to, well, that didn't work.
Right.
I'm making bathtub gin and drinking my fool head off. And everyone's mad at me when I say no one should drink.
You know, the other thing is that there were some really amusing ways that people found their way around, because there was a religious exemption of prohibition. You could still have wine with communion, for example.
Oh, okay.
And you could still have ceremonial wine like Manischewitz for Passover, et cetera.
Right.
And then there were certain medicinal exemptions. And like, again, going back to San Francisco, like Fernet is one because it's like a digestive. And so people drank Fernet and it's ghastly, but people drank it. And there are all these exemptions, and then you could, people just started selling things where all you had to do was like pour water on it. Like there was like, there were like grape, you know, grape kits that had instructions like, you know, warning, do not fill with water and sugar and leave in a dark place kind of thing.
Yeah. Fermentation kits. Essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. That's interesting.
Pruno.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That is interesting. I have to tell you, because we took a break, I have no idea how much time we've been talking, but I'm sure it's an hour.
I've got 63 minutes and a half.
Right. So we did it. We wandered around and we dorked out about so many different things.
So many.
So many things. I think on the whole, we're going to say Arthur Gauss is a San Francisco dork. That's what we're going to say.
Oh, I'm a guy, San Francisco dork.
Right. A man who enjoys the place he grew up in, which is a rare thing. So embrace that, Arthur.
Yeah. I guess maybe I did kind of hide the ball on my one and true North Star dork.
Your true love. It's true.
Yeah.
But everybody, you should find Arthur Gauss on the internet. It's 800 Pound Gorilla has a new album out by him called Nice Jokes for Smart People. His name is Arthur Gauss, G-A-U-S. And his Twitter handle is @maniac_bowl, like Super Bowl, but Maniac Bowl.
Yeah, Maniac Bowl.
Yeah. And that is that Twitter, Instagram, and all the things?
Yeah, it's Twitter. I don't have a Facebook. Huh. But Twitter, Instagram, and those are
TikTok
the
TikTok or I don't know.
Me?
TikTok?
No, I'm not an especially good dancer.
Okay. And all right. Well, thank you so much for doing the show, Arthur.
Jackie, thank you so much for having me.
All right. And Rangers, you know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat. My hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?